special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
What's going on? Here we are with the latest episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show on the Golong Media Channel on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, James Bell. I'm the lead boxing analyst for the Cold Hard Truth on Sports, which is a blog that is online and through social media, the Cold Hard Truth on Sports, or the CHT on Sports. You can also follow the Boxing Source on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Instagram to get different thoughts and commentary on what's going on in the boxing world. Number to dial in to talk about boxing is 347-237-5539. That is 347-237-5539. Press one key to get on cue and you'll be able to talk live on the show. There's a lot to go over in this week's episode as Saturday night, or pretty much during the whole day Saturday, we had a good set of fights that were going on within the sport. And, you know, we wanted to see if we could cover most of those fights and, you know, get some feedback about, you know, what went down. So, I was able to, catch a lot of the telecasts there, most notably the telecasts that were on, Premier Boxing Champions had their presentation on primetime on Fox. And we also had, an episode of HBO Boxing After Dark. So, we had, those two, and also a couple of notable fights that were overseas, over in England. Wembley Arena had a fight card there with a couple of notable fighters, so we're going to be, getting into those as well. So, pretty much wanted to get right into the results here, and I'm going to, start off with what happened in the telecast where you had the PBC on Fox, where you had about three fights that were on televised on that card for Fox. And, they also had a couple of more fights that were on Fox Sports 1 after the main telecast was over. But I just wanted to get into, what happened at the Nassau Coliseum here first. First fight that was on the telecast there for Fox was heavyweight fight between Adam Kalnacki and Archer Spilka. You had Kalnacki there, undefeated at 15-0, with basically 12 KOs going up against Archer Spilka, who came in there, 20-2. With two knockouts, of course, you had the fight that he had against Brian Jennings in 2014 where he got knocked out, and his last fight, which was back in January at the Barclays Center against Deontay Wilder for the WBC Heavyweight Championship. So was a good little while. It's been 18 months since he had his last fight there. While he had Adam Kalnacki coming in, you know, fairly active, having about, you know, a couple of fights a year. Over the past couple of years, he was, you know, very active within 2015 and 2014. Did have a good little break between 2010 and 2013, but then, you know, got right back in it. And he came in there with, you know, a couple of TKO victories before facing Artur Spilka. So, think, you know, some people were, you know, interested to see how Spilka was going to respond to his loss against Deontay Wilder, where, you know, he was doing fairly well, I would say, in the first three or four rounds against Wilder, you know, basically moving his head around and getting into the inside against Deontay Wilder to get some success before Wilder was able to pick things up, get the jab working, and get back into the fight, and then, you know, eventually, you know, get him caught with the right hand that knocked Spilka out. So this fight here between, you know, two Polish-born fighters that was, you know, that was going to be held here in New York. And, you know, if there was, like, anybody that was, you know, at the Barclays Center for that fight, that fight card with the main event of Deontay Wilder and Artur Spilka, they would know that there were a lot of Polish fans there in the arena. It was pretty much packed there. So you did actually have, you know, Kalnacki as part of that card there as he, you know, fought Danny Kelly there as part of the undercard before Spilka went up against Deontay Wilder. And so DiBella looks like he, you know, matched these guys up together for this particular fight here in the heavyweight division. And it was, you know, pretty much a action-packed few rounds there between these two guys. You know, Kanaki was pretty much going right after Artur Spilka, just pursuing him, being relentless, throwing a lot of punches, throwing, you know, I was saying he was like giving Spilka a lot of pressure there, and it was just seeing if Spilka was going to be able to adjust, throw counters, and see if he could, you know, throw Kanaki off his game. But, you know, after the first couple of rounds, it seemed like Spilka was in a lot of trouble. He was able to, you know, get through, you know, first few rounds or so, you know, but, you know, within the, you know, that fourth round or something like that, it seemed like Spilka was just standing on the ropes and, you know, waiting for Kanaki to throw something at him. And he just allowed Kanaki to get his big punches off and, you know, ended up hurting Spilka. And he was, you know, first he was knocked down by a barrage by Adam Kanaki. And then he was able to get up from that. And then he was, you know, blitzed in the corner and got hit with a couple of good shots that really stunned him. And then the referee stepped in to stop the bout in the fourth round. So Kalnacki was able to get the win there to move to 16-0 and register his 13th knockout of his career, while Spilka has his second consecutive knockout loss, going down to 20-3. And this would probably, you know, try to get Adam Kalnacki into the heavyweight rankings here, as, you know, he's, you know, a notable guy that, you know, defeated a guy that took on the WBC heavyweight champion, Deontay Wilder. So you may see him enter into the WBC rankings here within the next month or so. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens there. So once again, fourth round TKO victory by Adam Kalnaki over Alcha Spilka. And, you know, I'll go over a little bit more on that particular fight here later on in the show. Moving on to the second fight that was on that card there on Fox. Yeah, a light heavyweight bout between Marcus Brown and Sean Monahan. And to me, I was like looking at this because he had Marcus Brown in a PBC telecast beforehand, and he was able to, you know, get a knockout against Thomas Williams Jr. In February of 2017. Thomas Williams, who, you know, was a guy that was a contender for the WBC Light Heavyweight Championship in 2016, but lost by KO there, and then he ended up losing by KO to Marcus Brown in February of this year. And so, Marcus Brown here, you know, who was a former Olympian, and going up against Sean Monahan, who, you know, was also undefeated coming into the bout there at 28-0. Both of these guys from the New York City area. But both of them were pretty much familiar with each other. They were former sparring partners. We were able to train together many different occasions. But now they were going one-on-one against each other at the Nassau Coliseum in Uniondale, New York. And it just seemed like mismatch there once, you know, the fight, you know, started. He had, you know, Sean Monahan there, 35 years old, going against somebody that was almost 10 years younger, you know, a lot faster, you know, had a better reach too. So it was going to be something where Monahan would have to try to get into the inside and make it a tough fight for Marcus Brown. But Marcus Brown looked like he was able to do, you know, whatever he wanted early in this fight. And he was able to, you know, score, you know, a knockdown in round one. And Marcus Brown was trying to continue to pursue him. And he tried to finish the fight within round one. But there was like a borderline shot that Sean Monahan got hit with pretty much with like around a minute left in round one that, you know, halted the bout so that, you know, Monahan could, you know, catch his breath or whatever it was. And so you try to see if he could try to get back into it. But once round two happened, it was, you know, too much for Sean Monahan, and Marcus Brown was able to get the stoppage victory within round two. They didn't, you know, let Monahan continue. So Marcus Brown was able to move to 20-0 with a TKO victory over Sean Monahan and stay undefeated 20-0 now with 15 KOs. And he will surely move up in the light heavyweight rankings. Especially after, you know, what else has gone on within that division over the course of the night. So, you know, he's saying that, you know, after the fight, he was calling out the WBC champion Adonis Stevenson to a fight that, you know, he pretty much wants him next. So it was something that, you know, I kind of like saw him talking about that after, you know, he took out Thomas Williams Jr. because, I mean, you know, before Williams took on Marcus Brown, he took on Adonis Stevenson in that WBC light heavyweight title fight. So now it looks like, you know, Marcus Brown says like he's ready to take on the WBC champion there, you know, next. So he's going to see if he could get that shot here in a probably within this year, we're going to see if that's going to be able to happen. And in the main event on PBC on Fox, you had a welterweight bout between Omar Figueroa Jr. and Robert the Ghost Guerrero. Of course, we know about Ghost Guerrero. You know, has been a champion in multiple weight classes. He's been, you know, super featherweight champion. He's been featherweight champion. And he's also, you know, held a interim WBC championship at the welterweight division and challenged for other world titles. And he's going up against Omar Figueroa Jr., who was, you know, undefeated 26-1, former lightweight champion, but, you know, was out of commission almost for 2 years after he fought Antonio DeMarco. So with this return fight, he came in for, you know, a welterweight bout against Robert Guerrero. And one of the things that they were talking about here with Omar Figueroa Jr. when he was coming back was that he had to come down from, you know, a lot of weight before getting himself prepared for this fight against the Ghost Guerrero. And so they said that he was like starting out at 190 pounds and then going down to, you know, 147 in order to make this fight against Robert the Ghost Guerrero. And, you know, was a, you know, pretty much a inside type of fight between the two. And it just seemed like while Robert Guerrero was game for, you know, a couple of rounds, once he got caught with a vicious uppercut by Omar Figueroa and then went down, they pretty much signaled the beginning of the end for Robert Guerrero. And he ended up being knocked down 5 times, and that led to the TKO victory for Omar Figueroa Jr. And so now you have Figueroa there, you know, still undefeated, moving to 27-0-1. And Robert Guerrero falling to 33-6, with this being his third consecutive loss and his fifth loss in the last 7 fights. All right, before I get into the whole thing with HBO Boxing After Dark and the results from that, I want to get in area code 205 that's on here with us. What's going on?
Hey, what's going on, James? It's Mike Grady. How you doing, man?
Doing good here. Just went over, you know, what happened with the PBC on Fox card that was, you know, in New York. So anything you saw from any of those 3 fights there that you wanted to mention?
What was the first fight?
The first fight was the, you know, fight with Kanaki and Spilka.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. Spilka made his match that day. Like, he it looks like Konaki definitely studied him, and he kind of knew his tendencies and, like, kind of what he does, which ironically is the same thing that Deontay Wilder said when he said that he knew that he bent down a certain way every time he exited out. And so it was kind of like the same thing that he said that led to his downfall. So my boy definitely had his number. If this is the same guy who I saw fight before, we got to see more of him, because I don't think that was a great representation to see actually what he had. But it looks like he was pretty sharp, though. His body doesn't look that great, but he definitely looks kind of
right.
You know how something fools you?
The thing about Kaunaki is, I think they said that he usually fought, like, you know, much at a much bigger weight than what he was coming into this fight. Like, I've seen, like, as recently as last year, he went into a fight at 265 pounds nearly. And this is somebody that's, you know, it's 6'3".
How much was it yesterday?
I think it was around like 240 something.
Okay. Yeah, but I mean, the dude seemed like he got coordination because he had pretty good control over his body and like shot placement. He looked pretty good. Like, you know what I'm saying? You know how you can tell a guy is sort of skillful, or at least he practiced enough, whereas like repetition, like he definitely looked like he know how to throw his hands. And I mean, that makes me want to see him again against like somebody who hits him back, I guess. For the second fight, which was Marcus Brown, right?
Right.
Marcus Brown fought his sparring partner. I mean, it was kind of looked like a sparring match, I guess, where he – it didn't like his sparring partner necessarily was trying to come in there to hurt him. I mean, maybe he got caught before he actually had intentions to hurt him, but
– yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't much resistance. And so I know to your point where you said where you spoke on him trying to maybe fight Stevenson. I mean, I think that'd be a good matchup, but do you think Stevenson would take that risk? Like, what's in it for Stevenson? Why would Stevenson even take that risk outside of them both being under Al Haymon? Which I guess Haymon is doing that. He's making people fight now. But I don't
see
why.
Yeah, it seems like the push is to, you know, make these guys fight now when Adonis Stevenson is pretty much, you know, run his course as far as, like, his voluntary defenses. I think, you know, he was at one point the lineal light heavyweight champion, but with these, you know, voluntary defenses, this string of voluntary defenses that he's had, he, you know, ended up losing that. So, I mean, now it is, you know, a matter of time where he's going to have to face, you know, his number one contender for one, or face, you know, Marcus Brown, who's going to end up moving up in the rankings here.
Yeah. But I'd be interested to see that fight, you know, see somebody who would definitely hit Stevenson back and maybe wouldn't be susceptible to just his left hand. Because, you know, he's a dominant one-hand fighter. So, you know, he like hitting people with the left hand. And if somebody just could stay away from that, I would imagine he'll have a rough outing like he has had, I guess, in the past when people wasn't necessarily getting hit by that. But for the main event, I thought it was going to be a good matchup, you know, coming out in the first round where Danny Garcia spoke on Figueroa, how he's a slow starter and he don't get working until, you know, after one or two rounds. That was definitely the truth. Because, you know, looking at his body, he was like, oh, man, this dude out of shape. He probably can't throw them 100 punches around that he used to throwing. And, you know, when he was throwing at first, it was kind of like, I'm going to liken him to Paul Williams. You know, Paul Williams threw 100 punches, but he wasn't throwing punches to, like, hurt people. He was throwing it to break them down. It was like a marathon. He knew that if his work rate was higher than yours, you wouldn't beat him. And so with that being said, Paul Williams got hit way too much. And so Figueroa, in his previous fights, got hit way too much because he, you know, he throwing all them punches and stuff. And so I liken his style to Paul Williams. But with that being said, he ain't usually knocking people out. But, you know, I guess he had the right matchup in this fight where Guerrero has regressed or is past his best days. And, you know, he kind of was just there, like laying to be hit. Like, you know, he was like bending over, had his head in his chest, which I'm glad they said they practiced that because, I mean, what do you do if somebody comes and having their head in your chest? You know, you should let that uppercut go. And so it was like they said, a punch that he didn't see, but it was like, you know, probably the nastiest punch I seen this dude throw because he sat there, he planted his feet, and he like let his hand go. You know, like he was, shoot, you could tell he put a lot in that punch. But I mean, the punch probably didn't even really have to be that hard because Robert Guerrero didn't see the punch. So
yeah.
You know, sad to say, but Guerrero might be done as a semi-elite fighter, you know, as a B-minus-ish fighter. He might even be done as that level fighter because I think in his prime he was a B-minus-ish fighter, you know, and he's probably done as that. I have to give him credit because he's a true warrior. And, you know, it took a lot of heart for him to get up from that first punch because, you know, he was probably hurting when he got caught with that punch he didn't see. And for him to get up and, like, rally like he did, like, you could tell a man's character. When you hit him, he's like, okay, you're going to take me out? I'm going to go out swinging. And so, you know, he rallied. He
right.
definitely, you know, kind of made Figueroa kind of think about just coming at him all wild or anything like that. But then, you know, he just kept putting his head in the man's chest, and he couldn't get away from the uppercut. And, I mean, this speaks to the point that we've mentioned before. There's no way that a fighter can continue to fight a gauntlet of top fighters back-to-back and their body not start to betray them. And I think Robert Guerrero, you know, his body, it already started betraying him, obviously. But, I mean, this is just a byproduct of that bitter part of this sport where you can't be the guy in there fighting all these top guys, you know, Devin Alexander, Robert Guerrero. It probably might happen to Sean Porter, too. But Porter's style is such that, you know, his work rate and stuff like that, it breaks people down. But what you about to say about Porter?
Now, the thing with Porter is I think he kind of, like, trains a little bit different than somebody like Guerrero, because Porter has, like, a training style where he trains almost, like, 24-7, 365. He doesn't, like, take a break, and then once a fight is lined up, he starts training. He's pretty much, like, in the gym every day. You know, somebody like Guerrero, where, you know, he's had this string of, you know, big fights, and actually he's been in the game a long time. He's been in the game 16 years. So, you know, like you were saying, it's kind of, like, caught up to him. You know, he's pretty much had his, you know, peak around 2009 through, you know, 2012 before he fought Floyd Mayweather, where he was able to, you know, win, you know, multiple championships in multiple divisions. And then once he, you know, got up to the welterweight division, that was pretty much his peak and his limit. So he wasn't, you know, able to hang with the elite welterweights there once he got to that point. I've got Erico 813 in here with us live. What's going on?
Hey, what's up, Jay? What's up, Mike? What's going on? Just checking in from Tampa, of course. Just trying to catch a tail end on what you guys are talking about. But definitely, like Mike has said, and I know we said it in the past, Guerrero's definitely done as a B-level fighter. And in his best, he probably was a B-plus fighter. Like Jay outlined, definitely had his pretty much his the peak of his career probably in 2009, 2012, when he really got to be known as the ghost. Him, his dad, causing all those antics back and forth, particularly with that Mayweather fight, has definitely been on the decline since then. But not just Guerrero, but just kind of what you guys are talking about, training style. How does your training style enable you to have a long, productive career? And like you said, with Porter is like has a football background. He trains all the time. He's never out of shape. You look at somebody like Broner. Broner typically gains 30 to 40 pounds when he's not fighting, and you think about that, that's ridiculous. I mean, granted, everybody wants to live their life and not consume boxing 24/7 and not have it consume you towards the fact that you don't like to do it anymore. You need, of course, we need a break and stuff like that. But you look at someone like Floyd Mayweather, the prime example. He's never overweight, things like that. Always in shape, always ready to go. You know, and so someone like a Guerrero, I don't know too much about his training style, his off season weight, stuff like that. One thing about Guerrero, you never heard him being overweight for a fight, in my recollection. But training style, how does that help you elongate your career? But like I said, even with a Porter, I really admire his training styles, always in the gym. But his body type, I think, affords him the ability to do that. He's a short, stocky fighter with his build. So he has a lot of muscle tissue that he can just afford to keep build up on and just being strong like that. And that affords him to his style that he has. That rough and tough style. But, I mean, Guerrero, he's had his day. He's definitely now a name opponent at this point. So, I mean, if he keeps on fighting, It's just going to be for his name. So, that, I mean, we've seen this time and time again in boxing where someone's had a heyday for a good while, and then they just think, bottom line, you don't have it no more. That's where he's at right now, definitely.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, like, what happens here with Robert Guerrero, because he faced a guy here with Figueroa who, you know, had, like, a long layoff, one, and then two. I mean, Figueroa really isn't, you know, built to be in the welterweight division. I mean, right after the fight, they were, you know, saying that he was going to go back into the 140-pound division to see if, you know, he could try his luck there. So, I mean, I just don't see, like, where Guerrero will be able to have much success against, you know, anybody that's, you know, in the top level of the welterweight division, or maybe they'll have somebody lined up for him that's, you know, an up-and-comer at welterweight who, like, soon, you know, see if he could go up the rankings, and Guerrero could be a barometer before he faces somebody that's, like, within the top 15 or top 20 within the welterweight division.
So, speaking on Figueroa's, like, going back down, I wondered if, like, I know that he probably is a 140 and below-ish fighter, but, okay, yeah, Guerrero wasn't looking at the punch, but compared to how he normally hit, seemed like he was a little stronger yesterday. Am I correct?
Figueroa?
Yeah, it's like he was just a lot stronger.
Yeah,
yesterday.
Yeah.
Like,
well, yeah.
Started,
well,
like,
and the thing is, and like I was saying, it was notable, like, in the first round, they were saying that Figueroa, like, before preparing for this fight against Guerrero, he was like, weighing in at 190 pounds. Like, usually you have fighters that kind of, like, start off training camp, like, within, like, 15 to 10 or, you know, as high as, like, 20 pounds over, you know, their weight that they're supposed to be fighting at. But 190 pounds is a lot to go down from in order to, you know, prepare for a fight that's slated for 147 pounds. So, I mean, yeah, it looked like, you know, he had, you know, a little bit of, you know, power behind what he was throwing with his punches. But it's a matter of if he was, you know, comfortable being there at 147, and, you know, initially they're saying that, nah, they don't want to keep him at 147. They want to see if he could try the 140-pound division.
Yeah, I mean, 147, he don't want them problems against, like, real fighters at 147. But, you know, like, where was he at first? 130 what?
Yeah, 130, 135.
Okay.
Well, at 130,
yeah,
because... I mean, yeah, he started at 130 and then, you know, came over to 135. He won the title at 135. But he didn't really defend that world title all that much. He only had, like, one defense of the world title before, like, moving up or, you know, going up against other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably 140 is his best bet. But hey, I'm excited to see him. I didn't expect him to. I expected it to be a more grueling fight because I thought he didn't have any power by him. But if he can keep any bit of that power at 140, then that dude's gonna be dangerous. Because if he throw all them punches and have power behind them punches too, man, it's. That's crazy. 100 punches around, and then at least like half of them thrown with intentions too. That's bad news.
Yeah, other people have issues with him. I mean, he's already beat, you know, Ricky Burns at that weight class. So if he's, you know, going back to, you know, 140, he'll already have something where he has that win over Ricky Burns. So, you know, I'd like to see. What he would do against the, like, Amir Imam or Felix Diaz or Rancis Barthelemy if Barthelemy doesn't have a rematch against Carl Relic there where he got that technical decision over Relic. So there's a couple of good matchups that he could have there at the 140-pound division before seeing if he could get a crack at whoever wins between Crawford and Ndongo there. So that would be something, you know, for us to look out for. Moving on here, they had, you know, right after everything finished there for the PBC on Fox, HBO had their telecast, Boxing After Dark, where, you know, you had like a few fights there. You also had like a light heavyweight fight. One that I was pretty much interested in was Joe Smith Jr. going up against Sullivan Barrera. And there it looked like it was going to be almost like it started off as a blowout, and then it actually turned out to be a blowout. First round, Sullivan Barrera was pretty much outboxing Joe Smith Jr., and then he was, you know, caught into, you know, an exchange between him and Joe Smith Jr., and then he got caught with the right hand and, ended up being on the canvas for a little bit to give Joe Smith that first round 10-8. But after that, it was pretty much almost like a near boxing clinic by Sullivan Barrera, almost pitching a near shutout to get the unanimous decision victory over Joe Smith to win a minor light heavyweight championship, but, you know, basically moving up in the WBC rankings in light heavyweight. Of course, Joe Smith Jr., notable for his wins last year over Andre Fonfara and Bernard Hopkins, and Sullivan Barrera, who, you know, took on Andre Ward last year and nearly got shut out by Andre Ward there. But, you know, after that, had a couple of wins himself. So it was, you know, basically something where they seen how good Sullivan Barrera was against a guy like Joe Smith. But, I mean, people knew that Joe Smith really didn't have much boxing skill. It was just his power that, you know, carried him through a lot of the fights or a lot of the wins that he had. So as long as, you know, Barrera didn't take too much of a risk, he was going to cruise through this fight. And that's exactly what he did. You're kind of like seeing if Barrera may be the guy in line to fight Sergey Kovalev for Kovalev's, comeback fight after him losing to Andre Ward earlier this year. But I think that, you know, Barrera just, you know, looked very good here in this fight. And I'd like to see him against Kovalev to see if Kovalev can deal with somebody with the boxing skill of Sullivan Barrera with his, Cuban amateur background, and see if he's going to be able to, you know, fight guys like that. Because, you know, other than Andre Ward, you haven't really seen Kovalev fight someone, you know, with that type of boxing skill there, you know, except, probably once, I would say. He did have a little bit of issues with, Isaac Chalumba, but I don't think Chalumba is somebody that's, you know, at the level of a Sullivan Barrera in this case. So I'm going to start here with Mike. What was your thoughts about Barrera's performance against Joe Smith Jr. in that fight?
Talent tells over time, you know, like, as you said, and as the announcer said, as long as Barrera didn't give Joe Smith any opportunities, which he did, then the fight would be a boring, you know, one-sided-ish fight. But the thing about it, though, Joe Smith had his I'm not going to say he had his heart taken away, but he had his spirit broken, in my opinion. Because, don't get me wrong, he was trying to win, but he wasn't trying to win. You know what I'm saying? Like, I felt like in the back of his mind, he was like, if I crank it up and try to press the action, this dude will probably knock me out. I'm okay I understand there are levels to this game, and tonight he's better than me. Did y'all see that from him? Because I felt that from him when his coaches was like, "Dude, you're losing this fight. You need a knockout." And his demeanor wasn't like it normally is. It's like that workman demeanor. It wasn't like his demeanor normally is. Like, hey, you know,
Well,
I mean, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it almost didn't seem like. It didn't seem like at times that, you know, Smith was putting in an effort to, you know, try to make the fight a closer fight. But, I mean, to me, it just seemed like Barrera was just a much better fighter. If I like even go back to the Hopkins fight, I mean, to me, it was, I think Smith was like the same guy in this fight that he was in the Hopkins fight. It was just that Hopkins was 52 years old. He was facing a guy that was 52 years old. So you knew that, like, sooner or later, Hopkins was going to slow down and Smith was going to be able to catch up to him. So now he's facing – you're going from, you know, fighting somebody that was 52 years old to, you know, fighting somebody that's a little bit younger but has, like, a extensive pedigree that really, you know, hasn't had that many, you know, fights in his professional career up to this point. And so he's kind of, quote unquote, young in the game when it comes to professional fighting. So when you go through an adjustment like that, it's like, okay, now how do I prepare for somebody that moves, you know, a lot quicker, a lot better on the inside and the outside when you don't really use your legs all that much? So it was almost like a huge mismatch there by putting these two guys together.
Yeah, it was definitely a mismatch. But in that, I think his spirit, man, he just was thinking about, like, wow, I might get knocked out, because we saw from whichever other fight, I forgot which card it was, but maybe I don't know if it was the card in England, but it was somebody who was outmatched, but his heart is what kept him in the fight.
It probably was a card. I'm gonna talk about that fight here too. That was
later in the main event. Somebody was outmatched or one of these cards.
Yeah,
the skill was different, but then the guy, it kept him close.
That was the Burchell fight, I think you're talking about, Mike.
Burchell. Okay, yeah. I don't know. I just felt like it's hard. Let me be quiet, because I know it's different if you in there and you in front of somebody who you like, wow, this dude is just as strong as me. He's more skilled than me. He thinks better than me. That could be kind of scary, but
it was like, it's like you were saying, when he was in the corner and Joe Smith's trainers were talking to him, they were trying to, like, get into his head. It's like, yo, you're losing a fight. You got to do something. And so, yeah, you might have, you know, somebody in there that you're looking across the ring from that's, you know, that may be taller, that may be stronger, that may be faster, but you're going to have to do something to kind of, like, get the fight in your favor. Try to rough it up a little bit. You know, limit him throwing shots at you. You know, tie him up and try to, you know, get shots on the inside or whatever it is. You know, change the game up so that, you know, you'll be able to open up more chances for you to get that, you know, big shot in to, you know, kind of hurt your opponent. And it just didn't look like Smith was doing that. It was Barrera allowing Smith to get those opportunities.
And so imagine how scary that is, though. You know that if this guy doesn't allow me to trade with him, then I won't trade with him. Like, and then when you do trade with him, the dude get off first, starter. He get off first and probably hit you. When he throw three punches, he at least hit you with one of them punches. And then I don't know. I don't agree with it. Like, I would say, like, hopefully if I was in that position, I would, you know, try to overcome the adversity because that's what you want to do, mm-hmm. be picture perfect and yeah. fight through it and stuff like that. But if somebody just overmatch you, man, it's just, I don't know. I can see how difficult that was because, yeah, if he had pressed the action, he'd have got knocked out. And then, you know, even though he probably, have he got knocked out before?
Who, Smith? No, I don't think so.
Okay. I don't know. I just feel
Well, yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. But it was like early. Yeah, it was way back in his career, early in his career.
Okay, so back him remembering getting knocked out before was probably in the back of his mind, too, which is the same thing that Pacquiao was thinking when he was fighting Floyd. This exact same thing that happened. You know, he only just did enough to stay into the fight. Yes, it's different levels mm-hmm. and different skill levels and stuff, but the same thing that happened to the Pacquiao Floyd fight happened in this fight. And it's real. It's like, it's a real thing. That's where I can't. I empathize.
Yeah, it's like,
I think
yeah, it's hard to. Yeah, it's like very hard to explain that there, especially like you were saying, after, you know, a fighter goes through a set amount of rounds where he's, you know, pretty much overmatched, and, you know, it's very evident that the opponent has a big lead on you. It's like, what else do you do, or what else can you do in order to get back into it? Terrell, you got any comments on that lightweight fight?
Yeah, just as you guys were talking about this, it helped me just determine my thoughts, because, like, my initial reaction to this fight, to the result of this fight, should I say, is I was actually disappointed in Smith and everything. And the reason why I say that, Smith had that momentum from taking Hopkins out, albeit we know it was a supremely aged Hopkins. We know that. But still, he emphatically ended his career, and he'll always go down for that, you know. Aside from that, on the Southern Barrera side, I recall him from when he fought Ward. He was very game, but he's definitely not on Ward's level, and that's why Ward won that fight in the method that he did. But going back to this fight in Smith Barrera, like I said, for Smith, he had the momentum from beating Hopkins, and on top of that, he had been mentioned to fight Adonis Stevenson and everything. Although that fight never happened, but you got that buzz around you. You're hot. You got that promotion going for you, you know. So here he is coming, and like I said, facing a Barrera, who's been in there with Ward and other fighters that are solid top fighters in that sense. Not that there's a whole lot of names in that class, but Barrera has been in there, you know. And like I said, Jay, Smith's record, when you actually look at it, his experience as a whole, he's relatively on that young side still, you know. He hasn't been there with a whole lot of other lions, so I'm not sure if he underestimated Barrera or he just was riding in the high of the Hopkins win and stuff like that. Hope that wasn't the case. But, I mean, in this case, like you guys broke it down, in this case, I think it's just experience rolled out. And like I said, that's why we saw what we saw. But and even in that regard, when Barrera just started to take over the fight, boxing, and Smith had no return. I mean, you have to look at that, and your corners is imploring you to do something. You have to find a way. We've seen fighters tie their opponent up, fight in close, stay on the go, touch and go, stuff like that. You got to find a way to stay relevant in your fight, you know, in order to get that respect of your opponent. You got to find a way to win. We've seen that in many, many fights before. Make it dirty, whatever you got to do. So, like I said, for me, this point in Smith, hope he uses this as a lesson. Hey.
Yeah, hopefully he was able to, you know, like learn from it because, I mean, this was something where, you know, he knew that this would have been a, you know, a stepping stone in order to get closer to a title shot there in the light heavyweight division. And, you know, beating somebody, you know, with the skill level of a Sullivan Barrera, you know, would give him a whole lot more stock into getting one of those title fights if he was able to win. But, yeah, here it just looked like he was, you know, overmatched from the beginning. And, I mean, if he wanted to, he could have just, you know, tried to blitz Sullivan Barrera, you know, after he was able to score that knockdown in round one, but he wasn't able to, you know, do it. And that just ended up being his downfall here for the rest of that fight that, you know, ended up going 10 rounds. I thought it was interesting that the telecast had it scheduled for 12 rounds, and then they didn't know that at the last minute they changed it from 12 rounds to 10 rounds. And so when it was, you know, at the 10th round and the referee said it was the final round, the, you know, the HBO announcers were like, what? This is the final round? What happened? And then they, you know, later on got the notification that it was a 10-round fight. For those listening in here on Blogs, just adding in, for those listening on Blog Talk Radio that want to get in for the overtime period here, you can call in at 347-237-5539. Mike Grady, you had something to add?
Yeah, I will say I hope that this encourages Stevenson to fight Barrera, because, like, I don't want to see Ward have to fight two fights to be the undisputed champion in this division. Like, the other two belt holders need to fight, and then he fights that person.
Well, I mean, he'll have just about all he'll have all the belts. Right now, they're trying to force Stevenson to have a fight, you know, against the number one contender, Oliver Alvarez, here, because, you know, Alvarez has been the number one contender for a year and a half. And so you got to get that mandatory finally done first before having that unification fight against Andre Ward. So, I mean, it's still going to be like one little roadblock for, you know, an undisputed title fight to happen there at the light heavyweight division for Andre Ward. So I want it to happen, but, you know, right now it seems like, you know, they got to get Stevenson to fight Barrera first, and then after that we'll be able to get something in with Andre Ward there. Moving on with the results of there on HBO Boxing After Dark, you had, you know, one super featherweight championship on the line with Jezreel Corrales going up against Robinson Castellanos. And Castellanos is, notable for, you know, losing to Oscar Escandon last year. Was able to see that fight. That was at the DC Armory in March of last year for a interim belt. But then he came back this year, May 5th, going up against Yuriorkis Gamboa, and was able to have Gamboa quit on his stool there. So that set him up for this fight between him and Jezreel Corrales. Corrales being the defending WBA world super featherweight champion, which is kind of weird because you kind of have to have another belt in order to be a super champ. But, hey, that's a WBA for you. And this was like a kind of like an awkward fight from the get-go. You know, both of these guys, Corrales is a southpaw, and, you know, Castellanos being an orthodox fighter, and the way that Corrales, you know, has his stance, he's like wide in his stance, number one, and kind of like, you know, has his head up high once he, you know, approaches or comes after his opponent. Kind of like made for a lot of clashes, a lot of headbutts, and things like that. But it was, you know, fairly good back and forth fight without all of that stuff going on. And it just showed that, you know, Castellanos was, you know, is a very, very tough fighter. A lot of the losses that he had came in early in his career. You know, he came in there 24-12, and basically most of those losses came within his first 20 fights of his career. So after that, he, you know, was able to get a string of victories to, you know, move on up in the rankings within the featherweight division before moving up here to super featherweight. And he was able to score a couple of knockdowns against Corrales in this fight there. But eventually he did get caught with a knockdown in one of the rounds, but that came off of him blocking a punch that was coming to him. And then, you know, within the 10th round there, he got caught with a huge headbutt in a round 10 that cut him right below his eye, and that immediately stopped the fight. And so that the fight went to the scorecards, and Jezreel Corrales was able to get the technical decision with one judge calling it even and two judges putting it in favor of Jezreel Corrales. And one of the things here that was pointed out, just like the fight with Omar Figueroa Jr., with him coming in at 190 pounds, Jezreel Corrales came into the fight there as basically a welterweight. He came in there at 147 pounds, but that didn't look like it was much of a difference for Castellanos. He was able to, you know, get, you know, he was able to, you know, get with Jezreel Corrales, and, you know, it looked like, you know, with him having the experience against the level of competition that he's had, he was able to hang with Jezreel Corrales. And, you know, as the fight was going on, he almost looked like he was, you know, basically able to, you know, hang with him. He did score those knockdowns against Corrales to, you know, kind of like have a little bit of a either even in the fight once he got him or have a little bit of a lead. So if it was going to go 12 rounds, it was going to end up being a toss-up fight there. So for me, I was trying to see like how Corrales would look there, but Corrales looks like a very awkward fighter that, like Roy Jones was saying, he's a very athletic fighter, but he's not as technically sound as probably some of the other title holders in that super featherweight division. So I'm not sure how he would be able to fare against the other title holders there at 130. I mean, of course, you know, you have, you know, Gervonta Davis and Vasyl Lomachenko there. And, you know, we saw what Burchelt was able to do here in this main event against the number one contender for that WBC belt he had with Takashi Miura. So, I'm going to start with Terrell first, if you were able to catch it. What did you think about Corrales' performance here against Castellanos, or how Castellanos was able to hang with him? Yo, Terrell, you with us?
Let me go on the verb real quick. I'm inside of a place, so I won't hear background noise coming in. Sorry about that.
All right.
So I the second fight, I didn't really like watch it as much as I could have. Like, I saw bits and pieces, but not enough for me to speak on it intelligently. Maybe this was the fight where I heard Lethley and all of them saying that somebody's will to win was the difference. Are you talking about both or the main event or like the second fight? Which one?
It was – no, I'm talking about the second fight. To me, I kind of thought that Castellanos would have been able to, you know, hang with Corrales here, you know, after he was able to score those knockdowns. It just looked like, you know, at first I thought it would have been a mismatch looking at, you know, how Corrales just looked like he was, you know, bigger than Castellanos in the ring. But it does look like Corrales himself knows how to use his power if he has any. His stance was, like, very wide. He didn't look like he was, you know, able to get, you know, full extension out of his punches. So Castellanos was still, you know, able to hang with him no matter what Corrales was able to throw. And, I mean, if Castellanos didn't really get caught with the momentum of Corrales' punch to be knocked down in round seven, he would have been able to, you know, still hang with him, and the fight would have been in the balance. You know, one of the judges had it 96-92 in favor of Corrales, but I just kind of felt it was a little bit closer than that there for him. So one of the notes was that Corrales-Castellanos fight was basically a voluntary defense. There is Castellanos was just ranked number 10 in the WBA in the super featherweight division. So that I just found as a pretty interesting note. But yeah, going into that main event of that HBO card, you had Burchell going up against the number one contender Takashi Miura. Miura was part of a I think he was a member of a Fight of the Year candidate last year. Either it was like last year or 2 years. It was 2 years ago against Francisco Vargas for that same WBC super featherweight title. He was a former – he had that belt, but, you know, ended up losing it to Francisco Vargas in 2015 and then, you know, was able to get back to the number one contendership for that belt. And Burchell was a guy that ended up beating Vargas for the WBC super featherweight belt. And just looked like, you know, Burchell was a little bit too much for Takashi Miura. Miura was, like, looked like he was a couple of steps too slow in a lot of the rounds, but he was still, you know, still in front of Burchell. Still gaining. It looked like he was trying to get back into it late in the fight with a, you know, good set of body shots. But, you know, it just ended up being too little too late as Burchell was able to, you know, move to 32-1 with a unanimous decision win over Miura and was able to retain that WBC super featherweight championship. So, Mike, you were talking about Burchett a little bit here before I got into it. So you wanted to continue with that?
Yeah. So if I remember correctly, okay, yeah. So somebody bent over Matt. So definitely Miura was not the most skillful person in the match. It was Burchett. And Miura, you know, definitely committed to the body shots at some point, and he visibly had Burchell hurt. And so, to me, I am kind of upset with Miura's corner, because if he had to do hurt to the body and, you know, pretty much had him reeling, and, you know, it was a point to where you could see the momentum changing. And then, okay, I got to give credit to Burchell, too, because once Miura started going to his body, he started going to Miura's body. And then maybe that's what made Miura stop going to the body, because he was getting his body countered. But the thing is, he had to do hurt. And so even if he – if he was still getting hurt by uppercuts and all this other stuff, if he would have kept going to do body, it would have continued to hurt him. So I am upset with his corner for not telling him to go back down to his body, because at some point he only started throwing headshots. And I know for the last three rounds, he only was throwing headshots. He didn't throw any body shots. Partly being because Burchett was throwing the body shots at that point. But, like, how could you have this dude hurt in round seven or eight or whichever round it was, and then you not throw a body shot after that? Like, and the dude was hurt to the point to where you could see, you know, I was like, wow, is this guy about to quit and he done won damn near every round? You know what I'm saying? That's the type of anticipation that was building, the excitement and stuff. And then, like, how could his corner not tell him to go to the body? Like, that's crazy. I don't get that. That's kind of
upsetting. I think it was a bad job by their corner there to, you know, not continue to, you know, pursue the strategy that was working over the set of rounds that was there in the middle of the fight. I mean, you had something there. You had a game plan that was working. Why not continue with that plan and eventually, you know, break Burchell down and get back into the fight?
But that's why he didn't win, because they definitely let the plan go after it was working.
Yeah, they definitely gave up on that plan, and that ended up, you know, costing Yura the rest of the fight there. You know, even though, you know, early in the fight, it looked like Burchell pretty much had, like, a big lead and, you know, a big advantage in the first half of the fight.
Yep.
Yeah, so I'm going to see if I could get into, you know, what was happening overseas as well. You had, you know, the main event there that was at Wembley Arena with the IBO super middleweight title on the line. And this was, you know, also mentioned a little bit earlier. You had Arthur Abraham there at 46-5 going up against Chris Eubank Jr., moving up to the super middleweight division, coming up, you know, from middleweight. That was there at 24-1. And, you know, not only this super middleweight championship was on the line, but, you know, a spot with the World Boxing Super Series was in the line here as well. As, you know, they were trying to figure out, like, which one of these two here was going to be part of the Super Series. And so it just looked like Eubank was, you know, out there, pretty much getting the best of Arthur Abraham, you know, who's a, you know, longtime veteran there, but he nearly pitched a shutout with a score of 120-108 and then two scores of 118-110 to get the unanimous decision victory, and was able to put himself into the World Boxing Super Series here. So he'll be able to move on to face Abdi Yildirim in the quarterfinals of that World Boxing Super Series there. So, I mean, I think this is like a good start here for Chris Eubank to get, you know, into the mix in the super middleweight division. But I'd like to see, like, how we would fare against, you know, the likes of Callum Smith and George Groves, who are a couple of, you know, tough fighters themselves within that tournament, if he's able to end up matching against one of those two guys in the semifinals or in the final. So, you know, I'd have to see, like, how the whole bracket looks there to see if he's going to be able to fight one of those guys in the semifinals. Here starting either in September or October. Mike Grady, do you have, like, something here about how Eubank Jr. did against Arthur Abraham?
Yeah, well, I mean, he didn't really have many punches coming back at him, so I think that if a person could win, like, 99% of the time, if you throw in punches like you throwing them at a heavy bag, and then the punch is not coming back at you, that person can always win. And so I like what Eubank was doing. I felt like, you know, his win looked decent, but again, he didn't get hit. So it's like difficult to judge his progress because he didn't have much resistance. Like, don't get me wrong, I can't take away his win. I'm not saying anything to take away his win, but he didn't have a lot of resistance. You know what I'm saying? Like, you, it's just really difficult to judge how much or how well he would fare against top level, seeing that he didn't have no resistance. That's, yeah, it would have been nice to see a little resistance, but I guess what you expect with a 40, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, my thing about Yeah, go ahead, Terrell.
Yeah, given Abraham's style, we know he's fought this way for years. Fights out of that peekaboo style, tends to let an opponent wear himself out in that regard. And then from that point, Abraham gets in some strategic power shots. But like I said, we already know his punch output per round is not high at all. And at this point, what we saw last night, Abraham is definitely nothing more than a shell of himself at this point with his lack of output from last night. It was just, like Mike said, just he virtually gave no resistance back to Eubank Jr. And still, I know a lot of people probably feel the same way. How would have Eubank looked against Golovkin a year and a half ago, you know? So, all that said, you can't take nothing away from him. He prepared for the fight. He delivered. Got pretty much a shutout from that point. Got a good name on his resume. But even just going forward, like I said, secured this spot in the tournament. One thing I know Eubank Jr. has been talking about even before this fight with Abraham is that he would love to fight Groves. And it makes sense that from the same reasons, things like that, it makes sense. So hopefully they can meet here within the near future. Because like I said, it makes sense. Groves finally got his title about a month ago or whatever, so it makes sense. But, I mean, Eubank was like, he's like, hey, he's a great opponent. Abraham, he took everything I had. He knew he was hurting him, but he nevertheless, he couldn't get him out of there, which is what he was trying to do. You know, but just aside from that, he got a good win. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that was my thing here about Chris Eubank Jr. I mean, he, you know, only has that single loss against Billy Joe Saunders, and, you know, he wasn't able to get, like, a rematch against Saunders. He wasn't able to, you know, get a fight against Golovkin. So, you know, his next route was to just, you know, end up going up to super middleweight and see if he could try his luck there. And you know, he's able to beat the veteran and Arthur Abraham, and so now it's, you know, a matter of seeing how he does here in this World Boxing Super Series with, you know, a few guys there, like I was saying, George Groves, Jamie Cox, and Colin Smith is, you know, part of that Super Series, and seeing if he was going to be able to come out of this as the winner of that tournament. And so he, you know, if he's able to, you know, be successful in this particular tournament, then that, you know, just brings a lot more attention towards him, especially in England, where he would be able to build, you know, more star power within that area there. I think there was, like, you know, another, like, notable fight there. They had Lee Selby defending his IBF World Featherweight title against Jonathan Barros, and he was able to score a unanimous decision win there. And the notable thing about this fight was that he was able to defend the featherweight championship just a few days, you know, after you know, the passing of his mother. So he was able to motivate himself to, you know, still be able to make the fight and get the unanimous decision win over Jonathan Victor Barros to defend the IBF featherweight title. And I mean, I've kind of, like, said this a couple of times before, but I'm still waiting on if they're going to be able to make the matchup between him and Carl Frampton. That would be a very big fight over there in the United Kingdom. So you have Carl Frampton that, you know, recently lost Leo Santa Cruz and has, like, a fight upcoming here within the next couple of weeks. So maybe, you know, Frampton is able to get through this fight here that he has scheduled for July 29th, then they can match him up against Lee Selby. So that would be interesting if they're going to be able to put that together right there. Um, think that pretty much like covers like all that, you know, went down over the course of the weekend. It's just like, you know, we're, you know, kind of waiting a couple of weeks until the fight card on July 29th when you have Jermall Charlo going up against George Sebastian Heelan and the Mikey Garcia-Adrian Broner fight over in Brooklyn, New York. So you just have like a few things that are, you know, coming up. That is a big fight. Of course, in August, you have Terrence Crawford against Julius Ndongo for the light welterweight championship. So that pretty much like covers everything that was going on over the sport of boxing, you know, with the exception of the whole press tour between Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor, which, you know, I kind of like found interesting because, you know, leading up to, you know, from the announcement of the fight to before the press tour, you had a lot of people that kind of, you know, dismissed the fight, dismissed the matchup and things like that. But, you know, after the press tour, it kind of like seemed like the press tour did exactly what they intended to do, and that is bring in, you know, people who aren't necessarily interested in combat sports to kind of like talk about it. And to me, that kind of like would, you know, that would end up like having the actual fight be a fairly successful pay-per-view event, whether, you know, Mayweather wins or whatever happens, or if there's like any other boxing matches that happen within the fight card. It looks like they'll be able to end up having a very successful buy rate for this matchup. So is there like any thoughts about, you know, what happened over the course of the press tour, or, you know, the reactions to the press tour that, you know, either one of y'all wanted to talk about?
So I always have to take perspective. I think you summed it up best in that it brings fans who aren't normally boxing fans into the mix, and it promotes dialogue, it promotes interest, it promotes all this stuff. So business wise, I get it. This fight is probably going to do well, and you know, this cross sport thing, it's going to do very well. But I don't know. It's just kind of a mockery, man. It's kind of sad to see, but I get it. You got to worry about the business, but it's just kind of sad to see. I know Floyd better knock this motherfucker out, you know, because I want to make me a little money with Floyd getting the knockout. That's all I'm saying. I'll be okay. I'm not going to buy the fight, but I'm just saying. I just need Floyd to knock this man out so I can make some money.
Yeah. Because after the whole press tour thing was over, there was like a good little bit amount of money that came in for Conor McGregor. And to me, I just found that surprising that that people would, you know, kind of like put money in for McGregor. But, you know, you know how things are when it comes to like betting, especially when it's like a long shot bet, is that, you know, people would be like, you know what? Hey, what do I got to lose? You know, if McGregor wins, then I end up getting the big return on it. So why not? So I think that's what, you know, a lot of people thought once they, you know, put in their money for Conor McGregor there after this whole press tour thing kind of like ended. Terrell, what's your thoughts on it?
Let me say one more thing. I was kind of disappointed that just seeing the whole press tour and how it was just extra, like, you could see they were like, hey, we got to sell this. You got to be extra. I got to be extra. We got to, you know, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I haven't watched wrestling in a long time, and I felt like I was watching a strip from wrestling. You know, just like, it was pretty disappointing. Like, even just to hear the dialogue between them two, like, just the some stuff that was being said.
It's kind of a script from wrestling. Yeah, It kind of is, but it's almost like a bad script, or you know,
it's a terrible
or
script.
It's like somebody, it's somebody that's like a heel, but he doesn't have good mic skills. So it's like, yeah, you booing him, but it's not because of his mic skills. It's because of how good he is, you know, once he wrestles. But you put him on the mic, he's kind of horrible, and that's what I kind of got from. I kind of like got that from Floyd Mayweather. And the thing about it is, I kind of like seeing like it wasn't, like you were saying, it wasn't put together right, which is kind of weird to me because Conor McGregor, what he's, to me, I feel he's like known for his mic skills. Like before his fights in UFC, they kind of like, you know, show his mic skills and how he talks trash to his opponents, you know, before he's even in the octagon. So I didn't really see that much, you know, out of him here in this back and forth between him and Floyd Mayweather. All right, Terrell, you want to get in on it?
Terrell, one last time. All this money they put into this fight, they could at least had people goddamn tell them what to say. You know, just like kind of like give them some guideline, because it was bad, man. I was just like, are you kidding me? This is what I'm listening to. I didn't listen to a lot of it, but I'm just saying the stuff that I did hear, it was quite disappointing.
Yeah.
It was just very disappointing. I'm going to say that. You're like,
yes, especially in the first one.
Like, especially the first one. Okay. Maybe I only watched one, but I'm going to watch the fight because I like Badu Jack. And I think that the fight with, what's the other boy's name who should have a good fight on
Javonte
there?
Davis.
Javonte Davis. Javonte Davis, yeah, I think they're going to have good fights. So I wouldn't pay for it, but, I mean, I would go to the bar and watch it. So it's just so disappointing, though, just disappointing. And I've had, like, just people who ain't into boxing come and be like, I don't know. They said Conor could probably take Floyd, and I'm like, man, I just wanted to cut somebody out, but, you know, I'm like a grown-up, and I can't really do that. But just pretty disappointing, man. Just disappointed all the way around.
Yeah.
I'm just so disappointed.
But, yeah,
and
but it's like I was saying at the beginning, by you running into people saying stuff like that means that they've done exactly what they wanted to do with this particular fight. If they didn't really – like, if they didn't expect this much – you know, feedback coming from the general public out of this, they wouldn't have really done it. And,
yeah,
you know, by all of the people attending in Los Angeles and especially in Toronto and London, they were able to get back or they got what they wanted. And, yeah, it's a full go for this fight. All right, Terrell, now you can really get in.
Are you sure?
All right, Terrell.
Are you sure?
You could jump in. The jump ropes are ready. You could jump in.
Well, we could just call this a mic ready segment if you want to. No, for real though. I mean, all this whole promotional thing is the essence of boxing, and you got the good side of boxing. I'm not gonna say this is the bad side, but it's a part of boxing. And you guys know I referenced that movie some time ago. I think The Great White Pipe or something like that. I forgot who. I think Jamie Foxx was in there or somebody like that or whatever.
Damon Wayans.
Yeah. So that movie is what you're saying in real life. It's a spectacle. And, I mean, at this point, they're playing Floyd against as the bad guy. Conor's a good guy, back and forth, switching roles, things like that. The verbal assaults up on each other. McGregor rubbing Floyd's head, spanking from the back in the ring. One point I'll kind of say before the end, but I mean everything you're saying is just simply to promote this fight. And I've seen that Conor McGregor can chew gum a million miles per hour, look like a fish with his mouth moving so doggone fast. I mean, it is what it is. It's the promotion of an event. It's to get people to buy into the event, have a reason to tune in, have a reason to want to pay your $99.95 for HD or your $89.95 for standard definition. I mean, but the one most disappointing thing that I've witnessed, I think we all attest to this, is the comment that McGregor had, like, what was it, "Dance for me, boy." And
yeah.
it you know, as a man of color, it even hurts to even hear that. And it saddens me that has been bought into the promotion, because to my recollection, McGregor has never even had any reference of a racial problem as far as saying something wrong, doing something wrong towards people of color. And then for this to come out in this promotion, it just shows you that they'll stoop to any level to generate interest, to fire up people's interest, to fire people against Floyd or against McGregor, either way you want to go in this promotion. And
yeah.
that's one thing that's the disgusting part to me. Because I mean, as far as I know, I don't know McGregor personally. I don't think any of us do. But for him to speak that out, and you know, in this country, you don't say that, because you know what that means when someone of European color calls one of us a boy. That's not a good thing, and I won't tolerate it. I'm sure you guys won't either. But I mean, but it is what it is. The spectacle of boxing, you know. So there you go.
Yeah, it's kind of something that it really wasn't necessary to have that as part of like the added intrigue to this matchup. I mean, all they needed was, you know, the boxing versus MMA, you know, biggest, you know, stars in both combat sports to be going up against each other. And that, you know, we've had a bunch of times where, you know, boxers cross over to MMA and try their luck there. And so this is like the one time where it's the other side around. And so we didn't really need all of the extra stuff that was going into it, you know, that, you know, came out for that, you know, comment there in the first press tour that was in Los Angeles, or in the last one that was over in London. You know, where I think it was, you know, Floyd was saying something that, you know, kind of like came off as controversial to some people. So, you know, that wasn't, you know, something that was really necessary to, you know, build up this fight that's, you know, going on August 26th. So, you know, hopefully, you know, after, you know, things die down here after the next couple of weeks or so, and you know, the people, both of these fighters, get into their training camps or whatever it is, that it kind of like dies down. But, you know, once it gets closer, once it becomes like a couple weeks before and then a week before, it'll come up once again. And so, you know, we're going to see if that is going to have any lasting ramifications on it. But, I mean, yeah, in order to sell the fight, you didn't really need all that stuff, you know, on there to kind of sell the fight, but they, you know, made it part of that anyway. So we're going to see how that kind of like fares here, you know, once, you know, everything is, you know, all said and done. And but like I said, you know, in order to like sell the fight, they did what they needed to do. I mean, it was kind of like unorganized, but even in its unorganized state, it was able to do the job so far. It's been able to do the job that it's, you know, wanted to do as far as like an overall scale for the general public and in the boxing scale, because we also know the inside fighting that's going on between Floyd Mayweather and Oscar De La Hoya. And so, one, be able to get this fight on August 26th to overshadow the Miguel Cotto fight against Yoshihiro Kamagai. Mm-hmm. And then, two, more people are talking about this fight than they're talking about Canelo Golovkin. So they basically got a 2-for-1 by doing the press tour when they were able to do it and have the fight when they were able to have it. You know, so on that note, I'll pretty much in this episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show, we'll have, you know, another show here coming in next week, same time, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Go Long Media channel on Blog Talk Radio. We'll still have the sister show on Tuesday nights with Matthew Long, the Cold Hard Truth on Sports, Tuesdays at 8:30 p.m., so be sure to catch that. And like I say, at the end of every show here on the Boxing Source, the point of boxing is to hit and not get hit, not to stand and trade. On that note, I'm out. Have a good
evening. Later.